This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Well, Tim, rough week, certainly for markets. They got off to a rocky start on Monday. We saw the S&P having its biggest drop since May.
Much of that initial volatility due to fears over the Federal Reserve's plans for tapering asset purchases, as well as the Evergrande debt crisis in China. We're going to get to that in just a moment.
That's a story we talked about throughout the week because the news kept coming in on it. Ahead of it, though, a close look at America's pandemic response and how we can prevent the next one, because there is another one coming. That's according to FDA's former commissioner, Dr. Scott Gottlieb. He's got a new book out.
We're going to talk to him all about that. Plus, we're talking Cisco because the company outlines its sustainability commitments. And the CEO of Rocket Lab talks to us about a new era of space travel. Plus, it's our sooner than you think issue, and it explores breakthroughs on the horizon and everything from broadband to batteries, with our domestic cover story detailing the importance of cobalt to powering our future.
It's all the cool stuff that's happening.
It is a lot of cool stuff. Let's get those batteries here sooner than later.
Yeah, exactly. But we need some key components to make it all happen. All of that to come. We begin, though, with our international cover story on what's been the world's largest property developer and how it's creating a financial stress test that no one wanted. A takeover from our finance team and the editor of the section, Pat Regnier, who joins us now. Pat, Evergrande's massive liabilities, we saw that play out through the global markets. How come?
So Evergrande owes a massive $300 billion in liabilities, which sort of the sheer scale of that has people nervous. And the sheer number of people and entities that Evergrande owes money to. So there's just this kind of large pile of bills that people are waiting to get paid. And if they don't get paid, if they get paid back slowly and in a disorderly way, there's just a fear of the kinds of effects it can have really through the Chinese economy.
And of course, we saw it hit global markets earlier this week. But let's take a step back, Pat. And I think because a lot of people perhaps aren't familiar with what Evergrande is, despite its size.
I feel like it wasn't a household word, right?
Until this week. I completely agree with that. So what is this? Because this is a company that is not only in property, but it's in media, a theme park. Take us into it.
So it's a property developer. I kind of joked that this is what would happen if you had a financial company in trouble, but you also had a giant real estate company or a builder of homes in trouble, plus the New York Yankees, plus Disney, right? So, it's got all of these different businesses.
There's some perspective for you.
Yeah. But the really key part of the business is that it's a property developer. It builds housing. And when you're talking about a home builder in China, you're talking about a company that has been riding the wave of probably one of the most important transformations in human history. From 1998, the urban population of China has grown by, and I had to double check this when I saw it, something like 480 million people, right? So just in a very short period of time, a population the size of the United States has gone from the countryside to living in cities. And they've needed housing. And there's been a whole apparatus of policy designed to encourage housing, to get that housing built. And Evergrande rode that wave and became heavily indebted in the process. And meanwhile, policymakers in China have begun to kind of ask themselves if real estate-led growth is more risky than it's worth. And now they're trying to, they've set in place policies that have been meant to kind of cool off this change, but that's kind of a hard target to hit, right? You're saying, oh, real estate is risky. We want everybody to take less risk, so we're going to start to discourage all of this activity. But what can happen is what we're looking at now, which is this company is kind of cratering. And the question is will this be, a controlled cratering?
So where do policymakers come in terms of that controlled cratering? Do we know at this point what policymakers are going to allow happen to Evergrande? Is it going to fail?
And by policymakers, we mean Beijing, right?
Yeah, the Communist Party of China.
Yeah. Right. I mean, so I think one of the things that you have to remember is that the banking sector is state controlled in China, and that just gives them more levers than authorities in other countries have. I mean, they really have some power to, order how debts get disposed. And plus, I mean, you know, they have the power that every country that prints its own money does, you know, I mean, so they can create liquidity but they can also intervene very directly in the banking system, right? Whether or not, like, what you call a failure of Evergrande sort of depends on a question of definition. I mean, you know, if you have the state intervening to sort of quietly fold the company up, you know, like on one hand, you may prevent kind of a systemic risk. On the other hand, you know, there may not be a company that's recognizable as Evergrande at the end of that process. But, you know, sort of more importantly, you know, I think it's just always a question of a very big thing is happening. They have a lot of power to try to control it, but you just don't know if they're going to be able to do it. Debts and money markets. It's debts that are owed to, you know,
right.
Mom and pop investors.
Pat, a great cover story, a great take on Evergrande, which was really, no doubt about it, one of our big stories of the week. That's Business Week finance editor Pat Regnier. And Pat talked about that broader impact of China and what it's doing and the impact on the global economy. For more on that and China's push for common prosperity and what it means for private business, be sure to check out to our Monday interview with Bloomberg New Economy editorial director Andy Brown. You can find that on our podcast feed at Bloomberg.com.
Yeah, a fascinating story, right? a story mainly takes place in China, but with serious global implications, as we saw play out this week. Well, coming up, longtime Cisco executive Fran Katsoudis maps out her company's ongoing sustainability goals.
They've been working on this for years, and they continue to ramp it up. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Cisco Systems, Tim, they set the company's first greenhouse emissions reduction goal way back in 2006. They've been doing this for a long time. Since then, the tech giant has continued to grow its sustainability initiatives and impact year after year after year.
And earlier this month, the company announced a new commitment to achieve net zero emissions by 2040 and more. Fran Katsoudis is a longtime Cisco executive who's executive vice president and chief people policy and purpose officer. She stopped by this week to discuss this latest round of objectives.
First of all, before we get into sustainability, I do want to ask you about the visibility you see when it comes to your business and the company and hiring. What does it look like right now?
So we see a tremendous amount of opportunity. What's so fascinating is throughout the pandemic, we saw so many of our customers wanting to move a little bit more quickly from a transformation perspective. We saw that the issues they had been thinking about, they were ready to move. So what that means for us is we see a lot of investment in how they securely connect. They're thinking about having employees both on site, but also working from home, and that's a different technology play. From a people perspective, this has been one of the most remarkable times. Right now, people are talking about this period as the Great Resignation. Yeah. And what they mean by that is we see a tremendous amount of people movement as well.
Yeah, really important question when we think about the way that people are changing jobs, the way that people are potentially leaving the workforce. I want to go back to something that you said about the transformation that you saw throughout the pandemic. Do you see this as a permanent shift with a lot of your customers, that their employees could be working from home forever?
I think a lot of our customers are figuring that out. So I would say that there's a subset of our customers that absolutely have found greater productivity. They see better employee engagement, and they're going to continue to work hybrid. I don't see as many absolutes where people are either going to be all in the office or at home. I think they're figuring out the balance. And then there's a subset of our customers that want to go back. And that's something that we really question around, can we go back? And the reason I put that forward is that employees around the globe are telling us that they want to work in a very different way.
I mean, the horse has left the barn, right? When it comes to hybrid work, I think safe to say that there's probably been tons of focus groups pre-pandemic. Can it work? Can it not? Maybe we're not ready. I mean, the pandemic, we had no choice, and it worked.
Yeah, that's why we refer to this last period as not only challenging from a human perspective, but an experiment around work where we've learned a lot. And I think for some companies, this question that they had has now been answered, and that they can work, they can innovate, they can collaborate. And in some cases, they can be even better with this hybrid because they can get to talent that in the past they couldn't before.
Well, how has the talent acquisition process been? How has talent retention been at Cisco Systems? You said that some people are referring to this as the Great Resignation. We hear about the labor struggle that employers are facing right now. Tell us what it's been like for you.
And Fed Chief Jay Powell talking about it's a really tight labor force.
It is. So we experienced that as well. What was so fascinating was when we first went into the pandemic, we paused for a few weeks just from a hiring perspective. And we were just kind of getting our legs under us and understanding what this was going to be. And then we had this realization that we were in this for quite some time, and we started the hiring process. And what we found was leveraging video, leveraging the interview processes that we have, we hired like never before. And in fact, I would tell you that last year was probably one of the biggest hiring years that we've had as a company.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And so many employees have never met any of their colleagues face to face.
It's the position I'm in. I started in October last year here.
Yeah, exactly. And there's people that he's now meeting is like, I've been talking to you, you know, via remote, and now I'm finally meeting you. It's a very different world.
Yeah, I had a really funny experience last week where two colleagues were meeting. I happened to be there. And one of the colleagues said, we're friends though, even though I'm meeting you for the first time. And so what I would say is for all companies, we do see that there is a reduced labor pool. We're working incredibly hard to differentiate ourselves, to talk about what we stand for, and to attract the talent that really wants to be with us as well.
You were reminding us that Cisco's got a pretty big presence here in New York specifically.
We do. It's such an important market for us. So many of our customers are based here. Mm-hmm. It's a great place for talent, a lot of the technology as well. We're actually in the process at the moment of remodeling our presence here in New York. And big part of that is hybrid work. And so we're thinking a lot about when you come into the office, how will you work? And so I think you'll see our presence in New York look very different from what it's been in the past.
What do you mean by that? How is it going to be different?
So the biggest difference is fewer people will come into the office to work on email or to be in video calls. So when you come in now, you're coming in to be with your team. You're coming in to be with customers. And so the site has to be so much more team-centric than ever before. And so you're going to see a lot fewer of the cubes and the individual offices and a lot of huddle space.
How are you thinking about your presence in New York in the future in terms of headcount?
Yeah, I would say it's a really important growth area for us. And so we look at about five key areas across the U.S. New York is one of them. And so we will continue to hire and really attract and recruit the best.
You talked about it being a tight labor market. What's the New York labor market right now for the type of workers you're looking for? Just got about 15 seconds.
It's incredibly competitive. And so this is a place where the wonderful thing is you see the skills that we're looking for,
right.
But you see that the talent has a lot of different options.
So talk to us about the new commitments. Earlier this month, you guys laid it out, planning to achieve net zero emissions by 2040, achieve carbon neutrality for scope one and scope two. And that, I believe, is by 2025?
That's correct.
So go into it. Because you guys have been doing this for a long time. What's the difference? What's the new stuff that we need to know about?
Yeah, so I would say we have been doing this for a long time. And here's the most important part. For companies to achieve these goals, which are really big, and even bigger if you're a hardware and software company, it takes every part of the organization to be focused here. And it has to feel like a key part of running your business and not something that sits on the side, because these goals are pretty significant. And so we've been doing this for a long time. The four big areas that we're focused on right now, the first is hybrid work. As we talked about, we believe that will be incredibly positive for us. The second thing that we're doing is really focus on the reduction of carbon emissions. And we're investing in technologies that I think will give us all optimism. There's a company that we invested in called Remora. They actually won a prize with us. And they're doing carbon capture for large semi-trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so important. The third area that we're focused on is all about renewables. And so as an example, in the U.S., we're 100% renewable electricity, several countries across Europe as well, and we'll just keep on pushing. And then I think another element, and this is the most exciting, is we're looking at the way in which we're developing our products, which really power the internet. And one of our new products, Silicon One, is a chipset. And what it does is it reduces the amount of energy that our customers use by 26 times. And in addition to that, it's much smaller than previous products, so it doesn't take as much packaging. And so when you have this type of breakthrough across your portfolio, it's going to be incredibly meaningful.
That was Cisco's Executive VP and Chief People Policy and Purpose Officer, Fran Katsoudis.
Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, civilian space travel is now a reality. You know that, but our next guest says there is plenty of work left to do when it comes to the final frontier.
The CEO of Rocket Lab USA joins us. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business app and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
So there's been a lot going on when it comes to space tourism. I mean, Tim, you've been on the ground seeing it firsthand.
This 2021 is like the year of private space travel. I mean, you have Bezos, you have SpaceX with the recent civilian mission. Then, of course, earlier this year, you also had Virgin Galactic.
Exactly. It's definitely feeling like it's taken several steps forward. One company watching this year's spate of recent commercial space missions and the billionaires along for the ride is the launch provider and space systems company. It's called Rocket Lab USA.
Well, its founder, president, and CEO Peter Beck joined Carol and Shanali Basak to outline his company's plans for customer growth, as well as the risks and rewards of civilian space travel. Check it out.
It's super exciting to see kind of this new era of space exploration, especially by, civilians. But I think it's also important to remember, it still requires a billionaire to go to orbit. So I'm looking forward to the day where those barriers are broken a little bit more and space travel by humans is a little bit more frequent and achievable.
Peter, maybe you can explain the significance as well of what this particular mission means with SpaceX and the people that they are traveling with.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, it's an incredible achievement by friends over at SpaceX, and an all civilian crew is a wonderful next step. We're focused kind of the next step is actually providing resources and services from orbit down to Earth. So, human space travel is incredibly exciting and inspirational for us all. We actually rely on space for a tremendous amount of our everyday life activities.
Yeah, I feel like you're the practical side of it in terms of space, right? And I know Business Week has done stories about there's a ton of tiny satellites that are already up there in air, up in space, I guess I should say. Tell us about the work that you do, who you're working with, and I am curious about how much of your contracts and work you do is military versus kind of commercial.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we're an end-to-end space company. So, we operate a launch vehicle called Electron. It's the second most frequently launched rocket in the United States, behind SpaceX. And we deliver all kinds of customers. It's about 50% government, 50% commercial. So we're flying missions for obviously NASA, for the NRO, through to, we flew a small satellite for a series of high schools in Irvine, California. So just about every customer and satellite you could imagine, really.
What's the future in terms of space's role as it pertains to Earth? Because I think there's still a lot of mysticism and a lot of questions out there about, what space ultimately means for Earth going forward.
Human spaceflight is one important element, as we've mentioned. But I think little people realize how reliant they are in their everyday lives today on space infrastructure. I mean, if you call up a pizza and the pizza gets delivered to your house, well, actually, if it wasn't for GPS, your pizza might not get delivered to your house or might be cold. The most basic things are enabled by a lot of space infrastructure, whether it be communications or weather, and as we mentioned, GPS. But it's kind of like that hidden infrastructure. It's infrastructure that you can't go and physically touch or even see. So it's just kind of, magic. It's just always there and you're just using it in your everyday lives. And that's kind of the focus for us, really, is, how can we build that infrastructure in orbit and use that to really provide services to all of us down here on Earth? I think with the space industry, we've got some really great applications that everybody's familiar with, like communications and GPS. But, the access to space and to orbit is really only been broken down relatively recently with SpaceX and Rocket Lab. So we're really just at the beginning of what you can do in space and how that's going to improve and change everybody's lives down here.
Well, where do you see the industry going in the next 10 years then?
Yeah, so our view is kind of an end-to-end space company. So, we do launch. We also build spacecraft. We have contracts with NASA to go to the moon. We've got a couple of Mars missions. and of course, a number of commercial missions on orbit. And I think in 10 years' time, the really large space companies are not going to be just launch companies or just satellite companies. They're going to be end-to-end companies where you own the launch, you own the spacecraft, and you may even own the applications on orbit as well. I think that's what it's going to look like in the future.
Hey, 20 seconds left. Is it Elon Musk? Is it Bezos? Is it Branson that continue to dominate, in your view? Just quickly from your vantage point, just got about 20 seconds.
Well, I mean, certainly Elon is a force to be reckoned with, but don't count down the underdog Rocket Lab. That's all I'd say.
All right. Well, investors certainly aren't, because your stock's been on a tear, up more than 50% so far this year. Great to check in with you, and I hope we can get some more time with you in the future, because this is certainly an area I know we like to talk about. That's Rocket Lab USA founder, president, and CEO Peter Beck.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up next, former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb on lessons learned from the ongoing COVID crisis and his new book, Uncontrolled Spread, Why COVID-19 Crushed Us and How We Can Defeat the Next Pandemic.
Because, folks, there's going to be a next pandemic, according to Dr. Gottlieb and so many more. That interview coming up. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Dr. Scott Gottlieb, he is, no doubt about it, one of the constant and consistent go-to voices throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. He's had a front row seat to the health crisis. He's former commissioner of the FDA. He is on the boards of Illumina, Tempus, Pfizer, and more.
He's also resident fellow at the conservative think tank American Enterprise Institute and a healthcare investor at New Enterprise Associates. He's got a new book out, Uncontrolled Spread, Why COVID-19 Crushed Us and How We Can Defeat the Next Pandemic. We began by asking if the U.S. could have done things differently when the crisis first began nearly 2 years ago.
One thing we wanted to know, if the nation had shut down early on in the pandemic, let's say for 3 months, really shut down, federal mandatory shutdown, would we be in a better position today? And I'm just talking about the U.S. for a moment.
Yeah, I don't know that if we had implemented the stay-at-home order a lot earlier, it would have made an appreciable difference, and I don't think it would have been warranted. Certainly, once we knew that there was very dense spread in cities like New York, we should have implemented the mitigation, the stay-at-home recommendations earlier than we did. So we were a week or two late doing that in cities like New York. But the bigger problem was that we didn't have the ability to actually diagnose the infection. We didn't have a diagnostic test deployed at scale. It was something we could have done if we had proper planning. And because we didn't have a diagnostic test, not only did we not know how much spread was underway, so we were blind to the scope of the spread, and we didn't know the true nature of the threat, and that's partly why we shut down late. But we didn't know where the virus wasn't. There were parts of the country where COVID wasn't spreading yet, where we didn't have to implement the population-wide mitigation, where we could still use testing and tracing if we had a test deployed to try to contain the spread rather than telling everyone they had to stay in their homes. So that the lack of the ability to actually figure out where the virus was, but also where it wasn't, led to the wrong policy decisions.
Who made the right policy decisions at the time? What countries led the way? What countries are still leading the way? What's a good example of what we should have done?
Yeah, at the time, South Korea, I think, had probably the best initial response. I mean, every country has gone through waves of infection and made mistakes along the way. The U.S. has been disproportionately impacted by this. This has been an asymmetric risk to the United States. I think we've made a lot of mistakes along the way. But South Korea, early on, when the virus was first identified in China, got together their private industry, their diagnostic manufacturers, and promised them a very efficient process. If they got into the market, started to manufacture diagnostic kits at scale, they promised that they would be purchased by the government, and they also stood up testing sites. They started to lay the foundation for testing sites, and they actually pioneered the use of drive-through testing sites. The first drive-through testing sites were in South Korea, and because they were able to deploy diagnostic testing at a massive scale, they were able to identify their early infections, get people isolated, get people in quarantine, and keep the country from becoming epidemic. The epidemic really never took off in South Korea. I mean, they had subsequent waves of infection when B.1.1.7 and eventually the Delta variant started to spread later on.
Right.
But South Korea was on a similar trajectory of Italy and was able to contain it.
Dr. Gottlieb, why didn't we treat the warnings of a global pandemic that have been out there for years, so much so that there was a pandemic playbook conceived of during the Bush administration? Why wasn't that already in place? You've been on the inside. You've been involved in government on and off, I think, since roughly 2003. Why didn't we have the follow through? And I'm curious the conversations that you had about this.
Look, we had a pandemic playbook, and you're right. We had prepped
a pandemic contingency. In fact, the government had run a simulation called Crimson Contagion just before COVID struck, which was a simulated pandemic. The problem is we had always prepped for a pandemic involving a flu. We never envisioned that a pandemic could be caused, certainly by a coronavirus. We never envisioned anything but influenza. And the playbook that we had written for flu wasn't fully applicable to a coronavirus. There were many things that were different about this virus and about any coronavirus that don't make the kinds of contingencies that you develop for a flu widely applicable. For example, flu has a short incubation period, meaning that when you're exposed to it, you get sick from it pretty quickly, and typically you're not contagious until you develop symptoms. So trying to diagnose people who are asymptomatic carriers of the flu isn't as efficient. First of all, once they're exposed, they're going to become sick very quickly, and you're going to be able to identify them because they're going to have symptoms. When they're contagious, they have symptoms. With a coronavirus with a long incubation period, there's more of an opportunity to get someone diagnosed before they go on to spread the virus. And we also know that there's a lot of asymptomatic transmission with the coronavirus, with COVID. So it's more important to have a diagnostic test deployed where you're screening the population. So a lot of the things that we thought about that were planned for flu weren't applicable.
But I do want to push you a little bit, Dr. Gottlieb, about what were the internal conversations you were having at your time in the government when it comes to, hey, folks, we got to do something more serious. We got to make sure we've got the right things in place.
Yeah, at the time that I was in government, we really didn't have our eye on anything but influenza.
How did we miss it, especially that since there's a lot of vaccine hunters that are out there that we've talked to a bunch here at Bloomberg? They've been looking at this and seeing things that are out there that could be significant problems.
Yeah, certainly back in 2005 when the pandemic planning first began, that's when I was involved with it. We were really worried about a bird flu, H5N1. At that point, coronaviruses really hadn't emerged. But after SARS and MERS both emerged, we should have had the awareness that the coronaviruses were on the march. They were becoming more pathogenic. They were starting to threaten humans. And that a more contagious variation of SARS could come along and threaten the entire globe. Really, what we should have been focused on is a broad category of viruses, viruses that replicate through RNA, because a virus that replicates through RNA means that it can undergo rapid mutation, and viruses that could spread through respiratory droplets or aerosols. So those two features, viruses that replicate through RNA and spread through aerosols, are what give a virus the qualities that could create global contagion. And if you're looking at it through that lens, you're looking at that broad category, that includes influenza for sure, but it also includes coronaviruses, includes Nipah virus. It broadens the universe of the potential threats that could be the next pandemic.
Dr. Gottlieb, you dedicate this book to your three daughters. You're a dad, and I think that a lot of parents listening right now want to know about risk tolerance and about the way that you are behaving and the way that you want your family to behave during a pandemic, when perhaps some of kids are not vaccinated and some kids are old enough to be vaccinated. What are you doing with your family right now? What is safe to you? What's not safe to you?
Yeah, look, my kids are not vaccinated yet. They're not old enough to be vaccinated. They're under the age of 11. They will be vaccinated once they turn 12 and they're eligible. I think a lot of the residual anxiety that people who are vaccinated feel right now around COVID is the risk that they're going to bring an asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic infection back into the home, put their children at risk, or an elderly parent at risk, someone that they might be caring for who is at a more significant risk of having a bad outcome from COVID. I think once the vaccine can be extended to children, a lot of people who are vaccinated themselves and don't feel personally at risk from COVID, that they feel reasonably confident that if they were to get infected, that they're going to be protected from a severe outcome, I think they feel more confident about going out and about. And that's why I think a lot of people are still cautious. People who are vaccinated probably overestimate their risk in some cases. They're probably more protected than what they perceive. People who are unvaccinated, quite frankly, I think are underestimating their risk. They're probably at much more risk from COVID than they perceive. But I think a lot of the residual anxiety that people feel around the virus is around kids, and hopefully we'll have a vaccine for children very soon.
And I have to be quite honest with you. Tim and I talk about this every day with doctors and the medical community. I think there is a feeling like, I got the Pfizer vaccine, I got the Moderna vaccine. Like, there is a feeling that one is better than another. You've got a huge audience right now, a global audience. I mean, what do you say to them? How do we understand, especially as we continue to see studies out there, officials, regulations, you know, come in about these vaccines?
Yeah, it's not what the data shows. When you can pull any one study and try to make a claim that one vaccine might be slightly more beneficial than another vaccine in terms of its long-term efficacy or the absolute potency of the effectiveness that's delivering. But the totality of the data really shows that these vaccines are interchangeable. And all are providing durable protection. And they're all doing their job. They're fulfilling the original premise. Remember, the original premise of these vaccines was that they would protect you against severe disease and hospitalization. And all three vaccines are proving very effective at that.
I think something really frustrating to a lot of people right now, Dr. Gottlieb, is there's still, you know, you write about the lack of real-time testing and available testing, even, you know, almost 2 years into when we first discovered this. I still walk into a drugstore and I cannot get a Binance test, right? One of those from Abbott right. Labs. And I can't order them online. The availability is still not there. So you write about it in your book, How to Prepare for the Next Pandemic. We're still not getting through this one right now. We're still not learning the lessons that we should have learned almost 2 years ago.
Yeah, the problem is that we didn't scale the production of the tests that consumers prefer. What consumers want are at-home tests that they can deploy themselves that are easy to use, where they can get a readable result right in the privacy of their home. A lot of the tests that are available on the market that aren't selling out are the ones that either require you to send a swab off overnight so you don't get an instantaneous result, or you have to upload some data that the test reads out to get a result on your iPhone, and therefore you're reporting the result to an authority. People want to be able to test themselves within the privacy of their own home and make a determination what they do with that result. And those are the Binax Now tests, to your point, which are selling out, the Lumera test, which isn't available. So the tests that consumers want are the ones that aren't available. I think companies probably miscalculated and didn't fully appreciate what consumer preferences would be. But the reality is that this is a completely new category. The whole idea of making at-home tests available to diagnose patients for infectious diseases, that's a new category.
That's former FDA commissioner and board member at the gene sequencing company Illumina, also the big pharma company Pfizer. He's also a healthcare investor.
And of course, his new book, it's out now. It's called Uncontrolled Spread, Why COVID-19 Crushed Us and How We Can Defeat the Next Pandemic.
That wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Coming up in our next hour, our next wave of critical technological advancements, well, they're within reach. We're going to explore some of them, including the race to mine more cobalt so we can produce better batteries to power us into the future. That's our domestic cover story.
It's all part of the Sooner Than You Think issue. Plus, Peter Thiel's singular legacy in Silicon Valley, it definitely continues to grow. A new book by our own Max Chafkin explores the tech entrepreneur's vast influence in California and in Washington, D.C. as well.
This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including our own Max Chafkin on his just-released book, The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power.
Plus, how Amazon's most prolific fulfillment center is using robots and algorithms to ship out more than 1 million packages a day. Also, the White House's plan to bring high-speed internet access to rural America.
First up this hour, our domestic cover story. It's about the search for a better battery. It's part of our Sooner Than You Think issue. When we look at the latest achievements in technology that are changing the way we live across the globe, change is already happening.
To do that, let's bring in Jeff Muskus. He's a features editor at Bloomberg Business Week. Lots to discuss with him. This cover story by Drake Bennett. Jeff, let's talk about batteries and specifically what goes into them. Cobalt. I don't think a lot of people think about that when they plug their phones in or if they have an electric car, plug their car in to charge it. Why is cobalt so important to battery production and where are we finding it?
Thanks, guys. I'm proud of this one by Drake. Cobalt is one of the most critical elements along with nickel and lithium and a handful of other rare metals that go into our phones and will go into the next 1.2 billion electric batteries that we need to replace the world's internal combustion vehicles. But it's also one of the more conflicted metals on the planet. Most of the known reserves lie under Congo, a country, as you know, plagued by corruption and frequent wars, and where mining often occurs in dangerous, deadly conditions and not infrequently is done by kids.
You get into, or Drake, I should say, gets into this story and says, you know, there's kind of two ways of looking at this. We need more cobalt. So there's either finding more cobalt, most of which, as you said, is in the Congo, or figuring out how to use less. That's kind of the two ways of looking at it.
That's right. And for this story, Drake went both to the lab at University of Texas at Austin, where a team of people, some of whom have been working on this problem for decades, or feel like they're getting close to cobalt out of the batteries to some degree, or perhaps entirely. And he also jetted up to the far Arctic North, where people are trying to figure out how to find cobalt smarter and without having to rely on exploitative labor.
So what happens first? Do we figure out a way to develop high quality batteries without cobalt, or do we figure out a way to mine cobalt in a way that is sustainable and doesn't involve conflicted areas?
We kind of got to do everything at once.
Huh.
The problem is so urgent because solving the climate crisis requires solving the battery problem, which requires in large degree solving the cobalt problem. People are sort of trying these two tacks and a few others simultaneously. Some people are trying to recycle cobalt out of spent batteries at a better rate than we properly can right now. Other people are rethinking ore processing to try to make that more cost effective. And some people are trying to do deep sea mining on the ocean floor, which has its own environmental consequences. But these two approaches, finding smarter ways to find cobalt in the ground and ways to build the battery so that you don't need the cobalt so much, it seems right. Like the most promising.
Hey, Jeff, I do feel like there's a theme, at least for some of the stories that are in the Sooner Than You Think issues, and that has to do with scarcity. You're talking about scarcity when it comes to cobalt for batteries. Also increasingly scarce, and I want to get to another story in the issue by Liz Dunn, is water. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about... We learned a lot about water irrigation as a result of this story.
Liz's piece focused on micro-drip irrigation from a company in Israel that now is making its way into the parched American Southwest. It's also, like this battery story is based on a technology that we've sort of, known for decades. We've needed some version of, and that now that every summer is the hottest on record, and California is experiencing record wildfires every year or two, is becoming much more urgent. This piece, which focuses on a kind of drip irrigation that has been largely theoretical for most of the past century until the invention of this tiny plastic widget that seems to make it all much more cost-effective.
Carol mentioned the theme of scarcity. You touched on it. And we're also talking about the scarcity. I think this is going to be surprising to a lot of people listening. Mm-hmm. It certainly was to me. But more than 100 million Americans, Jeff, as Austin Carr points out in his feature about broadband internet access, 120 million Americans do not have access to high-speed internet. And I'm curious what the U.S. government is doing, or finally doing, in order to try to get these people connected.
Well, the good news for those 120 million or so Americans is that there are tens of billions of dollars in the Biden omnibus spending bill that's on the table right now that would go to finally closing this digital divide and bringing these people into a meaningful version of the 21st century digital world. Problem that Austin found as he toured the Arkansas Delta is that, that's still a price tag that might fall short if we're talking just about extending, fiber optic cables from the telecom companies to everybody's house. And so what some small telecoms are doing throughout the American South and elsewhere, as Austin writes in the piece, is taking more of a kitchen sink approach to
right.
Plant relays on the top of tall radio towers, or use wireless networks that can extend the equivalent of cable to people who otherwise can't get it.
There's a lot of moving parts to all of this, and as you said, Austin gets into all of it. Hey, listen, thank you so much. Bloomberg Businessweek features editor Jeff Muskis.
You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. Coming up, machines are running the show at Amazon's flagship fulfillment center, and they're forever impacting the jobs of humans in the process.
Taking care of it all, robots and algorithms. We go inside the e-commerce giant's test lab that ships more than 1 million packages a day. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Robots and algorithms, they are taking over. Tim, they're probably coming for our job as well.
I hope. I certainly hope not.
Please, I hope
not anytime soon.
Bosses, please don't listen.
Yeah, but are they as delightful as you, Carol?
Probably not.
Yeah, definitely not. Well, we are talking about the BFI4 facility, where machines are literally running the show. Bloomberg News technology reporter Matt Day takes us inside the massive facility, along with Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber.
The significance of this is that this was the first fulfillment center that was able to process more than 1 million packages a day. And so obviously that, you know, once they optimized that, it was like, where else can we take it? And the secret to that, though, as Matt has revealed, is that there's a lot of algorithms. There's a few robots, and the humans work for all of them. Right, Matt?
Yeah, that's right. Honestly, the starting point for this story, I met a guy who used to work at Amazon, went and jumped somewhere else, and he said, man, I'm doing so many things that I never had to do back when I was at an Amazon warehouse. They had just automated all of that for me.
Well, tell us more as you walk BFI4, which is this massive fulfillment center outside Seattle. Tell us about it. Did you go visit?
I did, yeah, and it's a place I've been a couple of times over the years writing about Amazon. You know, as Joel said, they love to have folks in for tours. They're really proud of the facility. It's just a big exurban rectangle, size of 15 football fields. You go in and there's this kind of low hum, but the weird thing for me is it's kind of quiet. You know, everybody's sort of in their own station. You know, most people probably by number are putting something in a shelf that's brought to them by a robot or retrieving something from a shelf and sending it on down the line. You know, a couple of thousand people a day just, you know, doing roughly most of them the same task over and over again, whether that's picking something off the shelf, putting it in a package and taking orders from a smartphone app the whole time.
What does your instinct tell you about a facility like this when you walk inside it and you see it? Does it seem like, given the number of packages it's able to process a day, does it seem like more people should be there?
You know, it really does. The place there's a low hum, but it is kind of eerily quiet. Like you would assume hearing figures like a million packages a day that there'd be more frenzy, but Amazon's just got it down to such a science that everyone's just sort of, you know, quietly going about their business at their station.
Quietly working for algorithms and robots. So what is the human toll of that?
Even told that, well, it's you know, working in an Amazon warehouse is often an unpleasant place, and that's been widely reported. Amazon's productivity tracking systems are real precise, right? They can tell when you're working, they can tell when you put down the scanner, you know. So if you're in one of these frontline jobs, there's always this voice, you know. Sometimes it's just literally a countdown clock on your workstation telling you, you know, exactly what they expect you to be able to do. And Amazon, a very aggressive company, sets that target real high. So that's the life for the front line. But one of the things that interested me, especially given that story is so well known, is so what the heck do managers do in this construct, right? If these people are working kind of self-directed, what are the people, you know, at the top of the pyramid in a building like this? What do they all do all day?
Well, they get to manage a lot more people, right?
They do. And a lot of what they do is HR, essentially. You know, they're trying to get the best out of people. They're trying to troubleshoot when something goes wrong, you know, just because, again, all of the software whizzes at Amazon have taken things out of their hands, right? They don't do staffing planning at a granular way a lot of, you know, warehouses in any company will do, right? Most places you go to work and, you know, the boss or the schedule tells you where to go. Here, the schedule is ripped out by algorithm, right? There's just so much that's been taken off their shoulders, you know, kind of with the aim of getting this thin line of managers to effectively manage thousands and thousands of people.
Just real basic question. What's BFI4 stand for? What is that?
So it is a reference to an airport in Seattle called Boeing Field. Every Amazon building across the country takes its name from whatever the regional airport is.
Okay, so that was a basic question I forgot to ask during the edit.
But a
confession.
Good one.
But
you get to know how the sausage is made when Joel comes to the studio.
So Matt, the other thing is, you know, obviously this is somewhat of a secret weapon for Amazon and has allowed them to really become such a dominant company. But how does this automation compare with, you know, the Walmarts and the Targets of the world that compete with them?
Folks are definitely closing the gap. Amazon has, you know, built a lot of its technology. It's bought a lot of its technology. We read about their seminal acquisition of a little robot maker called Kiva back in 2012. That gave them a real big head start. But companies, you know, are imitating what Amazon does, and they are closing that gap, right? Amazon's biggest advantage a few years ago was getting things out of these buildings as fast as they can. You know, today they're looking for secret sauce also, just because, you know, the Targets of the world, the Walmarts of the world are kind of taking their cues from
Amazon's roboticized fulfillment and putting it in their own operations.
Matt, from a financial perspective, the ultimate goal for any company that has this many employees is to reduce the number of employees because they're so expensive. Help us see into the future and Amazon's ability to actually automate nearly everything.
Yeah, Amazon has set aside full automation as a long-term goal. It's something their technology teams and their roboticists are working toward. I think realistically, they don't see that as practical for a long, long time. But that doesn't mean they can't get savings along the way, right? We talked to some folks who had insight into their Kiva acquisition and said they saved something like 30% on labor costs in the first implementations of their robots come to people operating method. So there's definitely a lot of costs that Amazon can look to reduce, you know, without going kind of that dream of a fully automated facility that doesn't require any humans at all.
So how much better has this stuff gotten with practice and time? Is there any sense of that?
We do know that, how to call it, in a 5 or 6 year period, they were maybe three times as fast, right? State-of-the-art warehouse, you know, roughly a decade ago, was doing something like 300,000 items a day, as you mentioned, kicking us off. This facility can do 1 million plus. That stat, though, I put an asterisk on, that's getting a couple of years old now, so it would not surprise me at all if Amazon is setting a new threshold and just isn't quite ready to brag about it yet.
All right, so to be feared or imitated or both?
Oh, it's certainly both, depending on your line of work. But yeah, they've definitely reshaped warehousing in their image with this kind of technology.
That's Bloomberg News tech reporter Matt Day, along with the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber. Check out Matt's story. It's featured in the Sooner Than You Think issue.
Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, some startling data on the number of Americans who lack high-speed internet access. You heard Jeff Muskus talk about this a little bit.
What some small telecoms are doing throughout the American South and elsewhere is taking more of a kitchen sink approach to plant relays on the top of tall radio towers or use wireless networks that can extend the equivalent of cable to people who otherwise can't get it.
We're going to get more of that story and what the Biden administration is doing to change all of that.
This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
So as you heard earlier from our features editor, Jeff Muskus, 120 million Americans are currently without access to high-speed internet in the United States. It's a number that the Biden administration is really trying to bring down with some help from the private sector, Tim.
The story is featured in the Business Week Sooner Than You Think issue, and the man who wrote the story is Bloomberg News tech reporter Austin Carr. He joined us to help us understand the country's digital divide.
It's just a different world than the internet have experienced versus the internet have not. Where I went to in the Arkansas Delta, which is about a couple hours outside of Little Rock, very remote, very rural parts, high poverty rates, low density population, and only recently one of the IS internet providers I talked with had just turned off their dial-up internet, which they had been charging 50 cents per hour.
Wow.
Since 1995. It's just a different world. You don't realize that they can't stream Netflix there. They can't do Zoom. They can't book a COVID appointment if they don't have internet access. And so what I wanted to show with this story is what it looks like on the ground as Washington considers tackling this digital divide with the infrastructure spending bill, which is making its way through Congress right now. It's through the House as well. And they're considering spending tens of billions of dollars on broadband deployment subsidies and giving us potentially the best shot in many years at really narrowing the gap. And the big debate is, how do we actually do that? What technologies do we invest in? What's the best bang for our buck? And this story shows what it's like, what the reality is like in places like rural Arkansas and what you saw in the Catskills, of how much it takes to actually close that divide with infrastructure on the ground.
Well, how much does it take? Because in order for my friends, and I actually spent a lot of time Saturday night talking to them about this, because this was the first time I had visited them in the 7 years that they've lived up there, that they had high-speed internet. Every other time, they've relied on a satellite to actually get them internet access, and they were capped at 15 gigs a month, which is really nothing. I mean, people use 15 gigs a month in a day if they're streaming something high definition, or in a couple days. And I wonder about the way that technology has changed, because they actually got cable laid down, which is very expensive. But you see companies like Starlink, Elon Musk's satellite company, being able to offer potentially lower cost solutions. So what's the technology needed here, and how much does it cost?
So in the Arkansas Delta, that the big debate is, how much do you spend on fiber, which is the gold standard. That's what you have with every high-speed internet pretty much in every wealthier urban part of America at this point. Or do you invest in sort of a riskier technology like Elon Musk's Starlink satellites, which orbit lower part over the Earth and zap coverage from space? There's 5G home internet, which is sort of a home-based version of what you get from, say, T-Mobile or AT&T or Verizon. Or there are fixed wireless tools, which like Citizen Broadband Radio Service, which is actually what a bunch of the local internet providers in Arkansas are using these days. It's a wireless spectrum historically used by the U.S. Navy to sort of beam radar transmissions, and the FCC has repurposed that spectrum for commercial use, allowing local players to sort of beam internet coverage using radio antennas, which sounds kind of old school, but it works for up to 6 miles. It's not as fast or reliable as fiber, but it gives decent speeds and costs a fraction of physically wiring up every home in America. And so this really comes down to this cost-benefit analysis of, in rural Arkansas, I'm told it can cost $50,000 or more to get a fiber optic cable laid into the ground, and that's not including trenching costs or construction, et cetera. And so how much are you willing to invest in that versus a far cheaper but maybe less reliable technology that might not be relevant in 10 years, that might need to be eventually replaced in fiber?
Hey, Austin, what's the other side of this coin here? The economic cost of not having these more than 100 million Americans connected with broadband internet. What's held back?
Yeah, it's a tragic cost. I'm not sure if it must be difficult to quantify, but it's something that the reason there's been more emphasis on this subject is because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Prior to the pandemic, a lot of folks had said that any infrastructure bill that came up, it was always about investing in roads or bridges or railroads. And when I talked to the Rural Broadband Association, they just kept saying, hey, it's also, in addition to roads and bridges, it's also broadband. And that didn't change. The Congress's perspective on that didn't really change until the COVID pandemic, when suddenly they realized employers couldn't have people working from home because they couldn't access Zoom, or kids couldn't work from home and do their homework because they didn't have internet access. But that's why this debate is really coming to the forefront right now in the infrastructure bill, of trying to solve that digital divide, because, man, we saw that during the pandemic, that the U.S. is just not prepared for a remote society.
That's Bloomberg News technology reporter Austin Carr. So many images at the beginning of the pandemic, when kids went to remote learning, of kids, outside of McDonald's, or as Austin talked about, outside a community center, because that's where high-speed internet was. The image of kids having to have fans on them because they were outside in hot weather. I mean, it's a stark reminder of where we are as a country when it comes to the digital divide.
Exactly. It's definitely a must read. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, we're going to welcome in Business Week features editor Max Chafkin, who is out with a new book, The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power.
It's all about the PayPal and Palantir co-founder and his rise to power to become one of big tech's most influential figures. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Billionaire investor, technology innovator and disruptor, and Trump supporter. These are all ways to describe Peter Thiel. You might recall last week's cover story. It focused on the Silicon Valley star, and it was an excerpt from a new book out by Business Week features editor Max Chafkin.
It's called The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power, an inside look at Thiel's rise from successful entrepreneur to big tech power broker. And Max joined on the day of the book's release. Check it out.
It's kind of a cool time to be having these conversations. Last week there was this kind of series of stories about Facebook, all these blockbuster Wall Street Journal stories, all the ways that Facebook is kind of, and maybe to put it gently, maybe ignoring their responsibilities to society. And I think, Thiel, as this longtime Facebook board member, longest serving board member, is a good sort of way into that.
Well, you bring that up and you remind me of really the beginning of your book, which talks about the way that technology has changed, especially in the context of the way we think about it. In 2016, I think you wrote, Silicon Valley was supposed to save us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that is kind of maybe the key to understanding a lot of these stories. So back, 15 or 20 years ago when Facebook in particular, but a lot of these Silicon Valley companies were really small, kind of these insurgent, troublemakers, there was this attitude of like, the rules don't matter. We're just going to do our thing. And the Facebook motto famously puts this, whatever, it's all about disruption and stuff. So I think that that attitude has kind of been spun forward, and these companies now are basically being held to account for that attitude, that the embrace of disruption as an end for its own sake.
So I want to go back to though. I remember when everybody started coming out that Peter Thiel was kind of buddy with Donald Trump, and we started seeing the pictures of it, and it was kind of a wait what moment for me. Like, wait, these two guys get along?
Yeah.
What is the relationship?
So it's hard to know exactly what the relationship is, but let me give you a couple of points. I mean, Thiel was the first big deal business person to support Donald Trump. If you look down the list of kind of speakers at the Republican National Convention in 2016, there are some big business names, but they tended to be kind of from real estate or from kind of these marginal industries where Trump maybe had a relationship. So you had, the UFC guy, you had Tom Barrack, whatever. These are big
my
names.
My Pillow and, dude.
Yeah, the pillow, My Pillow guy. But Thiel kind of brings an added level of stature as this big deal venture capitalist. Now that got him on the inside. He is not caricaturologically, if that's a word, he doesn't have a lot in common with Trump. He's very introverted. He's not boastful. On the other hand, the thing that was core to Trump's candidacy, I think, and to Trump's appeal is this idea that he's going to say the things that the elites are afraid to say, and that is something that Peter Thiel has cared about all his life. And you see it in his sort of business dealings. He has embraced these companies that are all about disrupting the status quo, kind of messing with existing institutions, and in his political dealings where he's kind of embraced these, basically provocateurs.
Max, I want to talk more about politics in just a second, but I want to get an understanding for how Peter Thiel, the Peter Thiel that we see today, the Peter Thiel I think that a lot of Americans met for the first time during the Republican National Convention when he spoke there in support of then-candidate Trump. What was that the point that he became that Peter Thiel?
Yeah, I mean, it built over, a couple of decades, and it kind of started. I mean, you go all the way back to his childhood. I do in the book. I mean, he was, smart, introverted guy, kind of bullied as a kid, and kind of basically pours a lot of that grievance, maybe you would call it, into this kind of activist career at the Stanford Review, which was a right-wing newspaper. He started at Stanford in the 80s. There's a lot of this going on, at the time. There were other, it's pretty similar to like the Dartmouth Review and the Cornell Review. There were a bunch of these kind of conservative bomb throwers. And Thiel does something almost very odd, which is then sort of after bumping around in law and banking, goes to Silicon Valley and starts PayPal. And then these PayPal co-founders, many of whom came from the Stanford Review, basically, joined in with him, and they become this kind of disruptive gang of troublemakers and of world builders, people who are investing in the most interesting, most profitable, most powerful companies, as his profile raises, he's still involved in that kind of conservative, political world, and I think that's what we saw, at the Republican National Convention. Thiel's speech, while not necessarily very polished, I think is a really important moment, both for like the history of the Trump presidency, but also as like the first openly gay person to acknowledge that at the Republican convention. He got a round of applause. Mm-hmm. And also his critique of Hillary Clinton in support of Trump was kind of a very smart formulation that I think was useful to Trump, which is that Trump is somebody who's going to blow up the system. The government's not working. And I think Thiel, served a really valuable purpose both to Trump and to the Republican Party.
Which is kind of interesting on a day where we talked to Bill Ferries covering Joe Biden at the UN, where Biden is kind of disrupting some of those old relationships. We thought it would get back to normal. We continue to kind of see that out there in force. I wonder what Peter Thiel's all about. What's his end game here? Especially as he, he's a disruptor, and yet he's backing political candidates. That feels like a much more traditional route for a leader.
So I think he's got kind of two end games. Thiel, we're talking about, during the break, he's a hedge fund guy at heart,
yeah.
And he wants to find good investments and optimize his portfolio and continue to grow his net worth. So he's continuing to invest, but of course, unlike a lot of hedge fund guys, Thiel also has a political project, and I think the political project is very much in line with his work as an investor, and that's kind of what makes him interesting. It's fairly unusual, although not, of course, unprecedented, because that's very similar to what the Koch brothers did for at least for a long time. Now, what he's doing now is trying to cultivate what you might think of as the post-Trump wing of the Republican Party. So these mm-hmm. are people who voted for Trump, who are really into Trumpism, and who want to see it continue. And Peter Thiel is one of those people. I mean, he has embraced the ideological component of Trumpism, if not totally, Donald Trump. And the candidates he's backing, so there are two big ones right now. One is J.D. Vance, who's running for Senate in Ohio, and the other is Blake Masters, who's running for Senate in Arizona. Thiel's given $10 million to each of them for each has a super PAC, and they are really running as kind of ideological extensions of Peter Thiel's worldview. Like their positions are very much in line with his ideas and also some of his business priorities. It's J.D. Vance not too long ago put out a statement, in support of crypto, and it's kind of interesting that an Ohio populist supports crypto. And yes, Thiel supported Trump, and yes, Trump kind of left the White House, in not under the best circumstances, of course, a pandemic, an insurrection. But Thiel, in a weird way, I think, is in an even better position now than he was, in 2016. Both Masters and Vance, kind of work for him. Masters is still an executive at Thiel's hedge fund, at the family office that manages Thiel's macro investments, and still works at the Thiel Foundation. J.D. Vance worked for Thiel. They've invested alongside one another. These men may or may not lose, but the sort of Peter Thiel as a behind-the-scenes power player, that is going to continue, and I think he could play a really big role in terms of shaping the direction of the country in 2022, 2024, and potentially beyond that.
Is that his legacy beyond business? I mean, from Stanford to PayPal to Palantir to before that suing Gawker, what's next for him? What's his legacy?
Yeah, I mean, I think his legacy is this, again, this far-right conservative project, which includes, hawkishness on immigration. That's a big part of it. It also includes the kind of nationalism, which, again, is very strange for somebody as a libertarian. But probably most importantly, it includes, the elevation of these disruptive companies. I mean, you brought up Palantir. That's a great one. And Palantir has grown tremendously over the last 5 years. It's on its way, if it's not already, becoming one of the main defense contractors.
Got to ask you, would Peter Thiel not be as interesting if Donald Trump hadn't come along and you hadn't seen that relationship, in your view?
No, 100%. If he had just stayed a Silicon Valley guy and just continued to be, the investor in Silicon Valley. I mean, we talk about investors all the time. They're really interesting. But of course, it's when you cross over into the economic, into the cultural realms that I think, and political realms, that it gets super interesting. Now, what I will say, though, is I think that backing of Donald Trump was almost inevitable. I mean, Thiel is not the only Silicon Valley guy we're seeing engage politically. We were talking during the break about Reid Hoffman, mm-hmm. Huge Democratic donor, and also, of course, a good friend of Peter Thiel's. And I think these companies, we're seeing, Facebook, Apple, Google, Amazon, they're all having to engage more with the U.S. government. So I think in some ways, Thiel was just a little bit ahead of the curve. He wasn't,
right.
These guys are all going to be playing this role, and they're going to be forced into it almost whether they like it or not, because when you get this big, regulators get interested, and then, companies will do what it takes to defend their interests.
That's Business Week features editor Max Chafkin on his new book, just released this week. It's called The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power.
Catch the entire conversation with Max. You can find that on our podcast feed. That wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks a lot for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into our Bloomberg Business Week daily show. It's Monday through Friday and starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast. Find that on YouTube. Just search on Bloomberg Global News.
Also, check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's great for weekend listening. I'm just going to point that out. Bloomberg Business Week
Also available on newsstands right now, also at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You can also see me at Bloomberg Quick Take, available at Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend.
This is Bloomberg.